Tonight on Arena. As he turns 85 this week, Michael Longley on A Life in Poetry, violinist Aoife Vrian plays live in studio, and three new films to review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Well, it's Thursday. Let's take a trip to the cinema first this evening. Tonight on Arena's film reviews, Sheep, Superheroes and Scary Monsters. Deadpool and Wolverine is Marvel's first R-rated superhero film, or 16s to you and me. Hugh Jackman is back as the moody one with the retractable claws, and Ryan Reynolds is back as the sarcastic one in the red suit, with British stars Emma Corrin and Matthew McFadden cast as villains. In the new Irish documentary Notes from Sheepland, visual artist Orla Barry explores her life as creative person and her life as a very dedicated sheep farmer. And we'll also review I Saw the TV Glow, quite a buzzy horror flick with a 90s vibe. John Maguire and Deirdre Mullumby have been to the movies and they join me now in studio. Where will we start? Well, I think where else but the Marvel Cinematic Universe. John, what brings Deadpool and Wolverine together? Do tell.
We're getting a sigh. I'll let you know a little secret, Aideen. Whenever I go to see a film, any film, the first question I always ask myself is, what did I get out of that? Not what it's about or if it's well told, but what did it offer me? What did I get? And Deadpool and Wolverine is one of the few films, the rare films, in fairness, that gave me absolutely nothing, because it has absolutely nothing to offer. There's nothing in it. It is resoundingly empty. So you ask me what brings them together. It's your usual Marvel Comics universe. It's the fate of the world. Deadpool has to save the world. His timeline, there's something that's taken from the Loki TV show, the Time Variance Authority. He's sent out to do this mission. It goes skew ways. He has to team up with Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, and the two of them have to try to save the world.
And of course, we thought Wolverine was gone, didn't we?
Did we? This is the 34th Marvel Comics universe, whatever film. I lost track 20 films ago, so you can't really ask me specifics, Aideen, because I can't answer. I don't know, and I don't care. That's the other thing. It's impossible to keep going back to the same story over and over again and expecting to get something out of it, anything out of it.
All right. So, Deirdre, how did you feel about it? And I mean, this is Ryan Reynolds all over it, really, isn't it?
That's just it. I think I enjoyed it slightly more than John.
Well, maybe that's okay.
Yeah,
that's okay.
You're smiling a little more, it has to be said. Yes.
Yes. I laughed a lot during this film. Okay. And I will admit that a lot of the movie is just joke after joke after joke. And it's very much Ryan Reynolds' sense of humour. So Ryan Reynolds, I think, has really become synonymous with Deadpool at this point. People don't know where Ryan Reynolds starts and where Wade Wilson ends. The two have become so merged together. And I mean, Ryan Reynolds, for this film, he does have the top screen writing credit, and you can absolutely see his sense of humour is stamped all over the movie in terms of its sense of humour. And I'd almost like argue that the film only dulls when it gets into the plots as opposed to the jokes, because that's what I came for. I came for fun, I came for laughs, so that's a lot of what I got out of the movie anyway. There are a lot of jokes made at the expense of Disney, at 20th Century Fox, and of course it was the merger between those two companies which essentially resulted in this movie. And a lot of jokes are made about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or so-called MCU. A lot of jokes are in there, as well as, you know, it becomes very meta. Ryan Reynolds makes some jokes about, like, Hugh Jackman himself and other actors who are playing the characters in the movie. And I just got a kick out of all of that, to be honest, because I suppose, like, you know, this is the third movie we've seen Deadpool in by now. You kind of know what you're getting when it comes to this franchise. But I will say that if you have been suffering from Ryan Reynolds' oversaturation, because he does seem to be just about everywhere. I mean, even just earlier this year, we got the film If, aka Imaginary Friends, starring him. He is kind of everywhere at the moment. So if you're getting a bit sick of him, this is just a lot more Ryan Reynolds.
Supposedly daring jokes about how Deadpool is going to offend the executives at Disney, who are the studio footing the bill, that are so obviously noted and screened and passed for production, that the joke instead becomes, how stupid do these people think we are? That kind of cynical self-awareness at this stage is neither ironic nor revisionist, and especially in the context of a Marvel movie where we've had 34 of them. It's the constant reminders that Reynolds introduces to Marvel's hegemony, that kind of, that this is it, this is all you get, especially this summer when we're short on blockbusters.
I know.
And we're watching Reynolds really have his cake and eat it too.
All right.
And that's to me, that you know, raises the hackles.
Let's take a little clip, shall we? In this early scene from the film, as the saying goes, a dead pool walks into a bar, which is, in this case, being propped up by Wolverine. We'll hear the voices here of Hugh Jackman and Ryan Reynolds.
Just give me one more drink and then I'll leave.
That's not how it works.
It does now. Leave the bottle.
I know you, Bub.
Nope, but I know you.
Everybody knows me. I'm the Wolverine.
Yes, you are, and I'm gonna need you to come with me right now.
Look, lady, I'm not interested.
Really getting into your cups.
Why would I go with you?
Because, unfortunately, I need you, and even more unfortunately, my entire world needs you.
You two gonna fight?
You gonna take that from him?
Yep.
I can tell you have a sort of don't get too close, I'll only break your heart vibe going here, but every other Wolverine would have really hurt me by now, and I'm sort of on the tick-tick, so upsy-daisy, here we go. Whoa.
Yeah, that is Hugh Jackman and Ryan Reynolds in Deadpool and Wolverine in cinemas this weekend. And Deirdre Malumbi and John Maguire are reviewers this evening. Interesting, as we mentioned, Deirdre, that it is 16 cert. This is the first Marvel movie that is R-rated in the States too. Is this going to work in terms of, I'm sure there are, you know, parents listening going, yeah, let's all go to a Marvel movie. They obviously can't go to this. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about how the box office will be. What do you think?
I mean, it's interesting. I think that this was something that was discussed around the Deadpool character. Even back when 20th Century Fox and Disney were merging, there was a fear of, oh no, are we going to make Deadpool a kind of 12A rated superhero, much like kind of his Marvel counterparts. But I mean, this film very much sets out from the offset that this is a 16 rated movie. We basically watch Deadpool as he plays with a corpse in the opening scene. He takes out his foes in a very bloody, very violent fashion while dancing to what is a very familiar 90s dance routine, which I think people will recognise. I won't spoil it, yes, because I know that people will get a kick out of that. So I think that people know that this is the Deadpool brand, that he is 16s, that he is R-rated. But I reckon that this movie will do actually quite well at the box office, because I think we've been seeing this trend recently of kind of fan service. Obviously, Avengers Endgame was like a huge, huge success for Marvel. But since then, we've had the film Spider-Man Far From Home. And this movie reminded me a lot in that you have a lot of kind of the characters from superhero movies of our youth returning to the big screen, the original actors playing them. There are a lot of cameos in this film, which I think that fans of not just Marvel, but superhero movies more generally are going to get a lot of kicks out of. Again, I won't kind of spoil anything because that's a lot of the fun in this. But I will admit that maybe there is something that's kind of lost in that cinema is kind of going in that direction than necessarily going for quality. But I will also say in this film's defense that Deadpool and Wolverine is a very, very funny cinematic effort compared to those films that have followed that trend so far. And I really enjoyed it on that basis.
And John, I'll come back to you in a moment, but in terms of just how funny it is, we're just going to take a second clip. This is in terms of their costume choices and just see do we find this funny or not.
So, what made you finally wear an honest-to-God costume? Mine's red, so they can't see me bleed. But I could see how yellow would be useful, too.
Have you been checked for ADHD?
Mm-mm. But I've had several STDs, which were probably caused by ADHD.
John?
If anything, Mary, I know I've been listening to what Deirdre has to say, and she's absolutely entitled to that. But for me, if anything, the more outrageous Deadpool tries to be, the more pasteurized the character and his antics become. It's like, ooh, Deadpool said a bad word. Oh dear, locks of mercy, pass the smelling salts.
Is it too self-indulgent? You said that Ryan Reynolds, having his cake and eat it, you said. Is it just
absolutely
all of it?
Absolutely. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to push the envelope of what is acceptable in a Marvel movie, even if it is rated 16s. He's trying to push as far as he can, but it's still not far enough. It's not revolutionary. He's not really a maverick character. And it's the wink is what gets me, is that everything is done with this cynical wink that I just I cannot get
over.
Do
you know what I have to tell you both, though? I am usually at press previews with you both, and I wasn't able to make it this week. So I went this morning to Cineworld at 10 o'clock, which was an interesting experience because the fans were there, I have to tell you. There was a good reaction around me. So whatever we're saying about the audience, people were enjoying it around me. So,
but that's the thing. You know. Reynolds is clearly having the time of his life playing this character, Aideen, and fair play to him. But this is the third time he's played him in a big film. And it's you've yet to have any kind of script or any kind of story or any kind of plot that matches his enthusiasm. So he's sticking out like
he's
a sore
thumb.
He's
having a great time, as
he's
season.
Having a great
having
time,
a super
but
time.
Everything else around him is just as poor as it could possibly be.
I'm afraid to ask you for stars, John.
No, don't be. One star, one reluctant star, I have to say, Aideen.
Okay.
It's that constant reminders of just how smart they think they are. I cannot get past
one star. What about you, Deirdre?
Well, I think if you're a fan of cheeky, fun, irreverent, self-referential comedy, there's a lot to laugh at and enjoy. It's not just necessarily for the fans. It's not a perfect movie. There are certainly flaws with the villain plot. It's very, very threadbare. And you get a lot more Deadpool than Wolverine for your buck,
you do,
I have to
yeah.
say. But at the same time, I'd give this 3.5 stars. I think that 3 stars in would be the critic in me, 4 stars as a fan, so 3.5 as a compromise.
We love when you disagree. 1 star and 3.5. Okay, let's move to something completely different. Our second film this evening in Cara Holmes' feature documentary, Notes from Sheepland, multidisciplinary artist Orla Barry invites us into her world, which comprises of a rich creative life and a busy working sheep farm in rural Ireland, where she grew up and returned to after many years abroad. Deirdre, this is an interesting one and it's a fascinating story. Can you tell us a little bit about Orla and our main character here?
Yes, so Orla Barry, she is both a hardworking and resilient sheep farmer and she's also this really creative visual artist. She talks about her poetry, her performance. She's really multidisciplinary. She's made film, sound and installations. And what's really interesting is that her career as a sheep farmer actually informs all of the artwork that she produces, even though sometimes that job also delays the rate at which she produces this incredible art. She kind of talks in the start of the film about her background. She came back to Ireland from Brussels in 2009 with her girlfriend and 2 sons. They lived over there for 16 years. And when she kind of got into sheep farming, it just felt like such a perfect meld for her. She felt like she'd done it all her life. And she really felt this sense of belonging and rebirth upon coming back to Ireland. So she talks a lot in the film about how these two roles and these two parts of her life have kind of blended to the point where she doesn't know if she's playing the role of farmer or artist from one day to the other. And the film is also quite interesting in that, like, stylistically, it also kind of mirrors back that that artistic background she has.
Let's hear from her. This is artist Orla Barry talking about how she made the decision to farm sheep.
We asked around, met people in the business. A farm advisor said that in organic systems, it would be best to do cattle or settle for salad. There was money to be made in salad, he said. Then he stood back and looked at us. Because I could see inside his mind and knew he wasn't a macho and that it wasn't because we were women that he had used the S word. It was because he realised that I was Orla with the ovine eyes. He saw sheep in my eyes. He saw into my future. And he knew I would become an ovine addict.
Yes, Orla with the ovine eyes. John, that clip, I think, gives us an idea of the sort of atmosphere that is created. But yeah. Also what we really get and what struck me was just the day-to-day grind of being a sheep farmer.
This is it. Orla Barry previously published her book Shaved Rapunzel, Scheherazade and the Shearling Ram from RKD, which was a collection of performance text and written works that explored this world, this different world, really, of and the intersection of where she's at as a sheep farmer and an artist. And she had a diary as well during COVID on about the same kind of issues. And The sheep are all a pedigree breed. They all have individual names. Yes. We get to tour the farm with her and her beautiful dog, which is this really interesting patch of land around a deep, cold central lake. It's a really dramatic and cinematic place. And we see the business of sheep farming, what it means, breeding and lambing, shearing, care, slaughter, wholesale meat manufacture. She goes into the entire, Cara Holmes goes into the entire gamut of what it means to do this work. And there's a great central story about how a sheared fleece taken off a sheep wholesales for 50 cent. But Orla Barry has to give the shearer 250 to do the job to get the fleece. So what does she do with something that this natural resource, this rare natural resource that's essentially worthless and is losing her money? And labour heavy money, and it can't be worthless, so she makes something with it. She keeps them in her shed in these huge bags, yes sir, three bags full, sir. Mm. And then she uses them in her work and makes use of them in that way. And the comment then becomes, why are these natural resources treated so poorly, and why are they essentially worthless in a global marketplace? Yeah. So all of that's really fascinating. That dynamic, that drama, is how this artist reconciles her daily labour, and it is labour, and her responsibilities to the land and her responsibility to her livestock, who she clearly loves and adores, with the process of then using that material to create art, and art that has something to say, and art that is very striking. And, you know, listening to the clip you just played, Aideen, on the headphones here, you get another dimension into the film, which is how beautiful it sounds. There's a soundtrack here from Verity Sussman and Matthew Sims. That's just absolutely gorgeous.
Lovely, yeah.
And how the work has been edited, how it was photographed. Luca Tuffarelli is the photographer. And this is technically very high level documentary filmmaking. And there's that playfulness with all of it as well. There's a performance from the Wexford Male Voice Choir. They just pop up in a field. And then now and again, we get a musician that pops up playing on a range of alpine horns.
We actually have a clip from that, John. Let's take a listen.
This is Male Voice Choir,
is it? No, we have the horn music. This is okay. Hannah Miller playing the horn to the flock of sheep. The sound of the alpine horn there from Notes from Sheepland. Deirdre, how is Orla represented on screen here? You know, we have her as the artist, the returned immigrant, the farmer. I mean, it's so physical when she's the farmer. The lambing season, for example, is so full on. Do you think she's an interesting enough character to hold us for this full documentary?
I think so, yeah. And it's interesting what you say about the way she's represented, because her presence in the film often comes out through voiceover narration. But then there are some striking close-ups. We see her kind of in the river while she's watching her sheep, kind of that whole shepherd vibe, just watching her flock from afar. That's really quite interesting. And even I was quite struck by a visual of her that came kind of later on in the film, where she's applying this red lipstick in slow motion. And it's at the point where she's kind of talking about animal testing in the cosmetics industry. And it's just a very kind of powerful moment. The environmental message there isn't in your face, but really kind of consumed subliminally. I suppose the tragedy of it really strikes you deep in the heart. And it's interesting because John kind of touched there on the whole idea of wool and how it was once so valuable as a commodity. And, now it's really lost kind of all its importance and relevance. And naturally, you know, what she also goes into in terms of her environmental, her conservationist message is how these sheep upsettingly become meat now.
Yeah.
We watch these lamb chops being cut up and packaged, and she talks about how they have to be in certain shapes and sizes in order to fit into these packaging. And it's quite an unsettling sight, even though, you know, we don't see anything kind of graphic aside from that. Your subconscious kind of fills in the
blanks. But her as a farmer, it's interesting to see her reaction on it. Mm. Let's go for stars, John.
Look, There's a point in the voiceover where Orla Barry says, when I say notes from Sheepland, it's maybe notes from the more primal side of life. And I think that's what the film gives us. In this beautiful way, it gives us an insight into what's really going on farms, what these industries actually mean to us as consumers. And I think that's really valuable. But even over 70 minutes, I'm not sure people are going to be flocking to see it, if you don't mind me saying so. But there are rewards here for the curious. And it is so... Cara Holmes used to be an editor. This is her debut documentary, and it is beautifully made. So 3 stars.
Three stars. And Deirdre?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with John there. Like, pacing and subject matter wise, it can be a little slow. It won't be for everyone. It's not exactly like high stakes, gripping entertainment or anything like that. But I do think that everyone who watches it will get something out of it. So yeah, 3 stars for me.
3 stars. Our final film tonight. I Saw the TV Glow. Themes of teenage isolation and obsession lie at the heart of writer-director Jane Schoenbrunn's second feature, I Saw the TV Glow. Two outsider adolescents get fixated on a strange TV show called The Pink Opaque. John, can you set the scene for us?
Well, we're in suburban New Jersey, Aideen. It's the early 1990s, I think, and we meet this withdrawn teenager called Owen. He's played by Justice Smith. He's estranged from his macho father, who's played by Fred Durst, the singer Fred Durst. He's already mourning his devoted mother, who's played by Danielle Deadwyler, who is terminally ill. He's also coming to terms with his sexuality and his gender identity. And then he meets this cynical outsider, Maddie, who's played by Bridget Lundy Payne. She's reading an episode guide. You know you're in the 90s. An episode guide to a television series that isolated Owen had never heard of, called The Pink Opaque. And that show, we see clips from it. It follows two teenagers who use their supernatural powers to fight scary monsters. It's very much in the vein of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yeah. I suppose. And the two bond over the show. Owen can't watch it because it's on after his bedtime and his father thinks it's for girls. So he watches VHS tapes. Another great signifier in the movie are these VHS tapes that Maddie makes for him. But then, disaster, after 5 years, the show is cancelled and the two are bereft. Just at the point, in fact, in which what they're watching on screen in this show has a kind of an eerie mirror to events that are happening and the issues that are affecting their own lives.
Okay, let's take a clip here where our two leads have a heart-to-heart.
If you wanted, I could come over again. I've been watching the tapes you've been making me, but I wanted to watch The Pink Opaque on Saturday night again while it airs.
I like girls, you know that, right? I'm not into boys.
Totally, that's fine.
Okay, I'm just making sure. What about you? Do you like girls?
I don't know.
Boys?
I think that I like TV shows.
Yeah, it's a powerful piece of dialogue. I think I like TV shows from I Saw the TV Glow. Deirdre, it's interesting really to call this a horror because there's angst, and even a review I saw today said it's sad. So what kind of genre are we talking about, do you think?
Yeah, and it's interesting because A24 is the distributor behind it and they'd kind of be known for their indie horror movies. But I'd almost kind of tend to describe this as like a psychological drama, because what it's really doing is deep diving into the psyches of these two characters, Owen and Maddie, and particularly Owen, as that distinction between reality and the TV show become blurred. There's some really interesting scenes, and I think the audience is left purposefully confused even when the movie ends. You're not quite sure what you saw. For example, there's one scene where Owen sticks his head through a TV and you don't know whether he's actually done it or not. So it's quite an interesting kind of exploration, I suppose, in that way, of the power of screens on our psyche and how they can really come to kind of mould our very identity, particularly at that young kind of impressionable age.
Okay, stars from you, Deirdre?
You know, I found its themes and subject matter were probably more interesting than the content of the film itself. I did find I was a bit frustrated. It was a little underdeveloped for me, so 2.5 stars.
2.5. And you, John?
I'd go along with Deirdre there. That I think Justice Smith's hesitant performance really started to drag on me very quickly, and it turns into this kind of torturous monotone. He never changes tone, and that sits very awkwardly with all the kind of high-toned nightmares that are going on around him. So three stars for me. Brave effort and a heartfelt story, but it just didn't come together.
Okay, thanks very much to you both. My thanks to Deirdre Malumbi and John Maguire. Deadpool and Wolverine is on general release today. And I saw the TV Glow and notes from Sheepland are in selected cinemas from tomorrow. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena with Aideen Gormley. Poet Michael Longley turns 85 this week, and to celebrate, his publisher Jonathan Cape has produced Ash Keys, a new book of selected poems. It spans over 50 years of poetry, from his debut collection, No Continuing City, in 1969, when he was part of that extraordinary generation coming out of the North, including Derek Mahon, Seamus Heaney and Maeve McGuckian, to Michael's latest collection, The Slain Birds. Ash Keys features lifelong themes including nature, love, sex, war, politics, the classics, and of course his beloved County Mayo. I'm delighted that Michael Longley joins me on the line now from Belfast. Good evening to you, Michael.
Hello, very nice to be here.
Lovely to have you with us. And, you know, we might just start with a poem because the new book is named after a poem I know your wife, Edna, particularly likes. Could I ask you to introduce and read Ash Keys for us?
Yes, I think I wanted the book to have a title rather than just New Selected Poems, which is doesn't exactly swing. So it was Edna who suggested Ash Keys, a poem about poetry, really, and about poetry's place in the natural world. It's six four-line stanzas, six quatrains. Ghosts of hedgers and ditchers, the ash trees rattling keys above tangles of hawthorn and bramble, alder and gorse, would keep me from pacing commonage, long perspectives and conversations, a field that touches the horizon. I'm herding cattle there as a boy, as the old man following in his footsteps, who begins the task again, as though there'd never been in some interim or hollow, wives and children, milk and buttermilk, market days. Far from the perimeter of watercress and berries, in the middle of the field, I stand talking to myself, while the ash keys scatter and the gates creak open and the barbed wire rusts to hay ropes strung with thorns.
Thank you, Michael. Michael Longley reading Ash Keys, and that is the title of the new book of selected poems. I couldn't help but wonder, with 12 poetry collections represented in Ash Keys, Michael, what was it like making the choices? How did you go about choosing? What was the experience like?
Well, with my wife, I went through the entire oeuvre, everything I'd chosen to publish, and picked out the poems that we liked the best, although there are quite a few poems that I liked that I left behind for a much later, I hope, collected poems. I hope it doesn't sound immodest, but I was rather pleased as the book assembled itself. And Ash Keys, the selected poems volume, in a way took me by surprise. And I take that as a good augur. If I'm not taken by surprise, nobody else is going to be taken by surprise by the work.
But I mean, you should have that sense of pride, as you say. It in a way, a book of new selected poems, it's like a greatest hits, isn't it? So I presume you feel good just holding this book in your hand at this stage.
Yes, it's rather reassuring to have to be able to hold it in my hand and to realise that it exists and that therefore I exist.
Well, Michael, you were writing poems at the age of 16, but really it was studying at Trinity College Dublin that gave you the space to write in earnest, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I wrote my first poems when I was about 16 or 17 in order to impress girlfriends, I think. But I was doing all sorts of other things. You know, I played rugby and had intense music sessions and so forth. So it wasn't until I got to Trinity where they, you had 7-week terms. There was plenty of space and time. And it was at Trinity that poetry became the central obsession of my life. At Trinity, I wrote several poems a day. They were all rubbish, but I was obsessed. And it wasn't until about a few years after Trinity that I learned that you have to wait for poems. They have to come to you, and that concentration is one of the aspects of a poem that I like. The Anglo-Welsh poet Edward Thomas talks about elliptical intensity. I think that's marvelous, and that's what I learned to try and generate in my poems. With not one word, one syllable out of place, every word earning its place in the poem. I think chattiness, verbosity, are bad influences in poetry. They're the opposite of poetry. In a mysterious way, the white space around the words in a poem are nearly as important as the words themselves. And when the words themselves make themselves heard, they're shattering that silence and filling that whiteness. So it's a question of knowing what to leave out,
yeah,
as much as how much to put in.
I'd love you to read maybe an early poem for us and give us the background to it. I'm thinking of Swans Mating from your second collection, An Exploded View. Tell us about Swans Mating.
Well, I wrote this poem, I suppose, in my early 30s. that's a long time ago. And it was inspired by sitting on a bench at the Grand Canal in Dublin on a Sunday afternoon walk. And lo and behold, two swans very obligingly stopped swimming past me and proceeded to mate, which was an extraordinarily dramatic sight. And I turned it into a love poem called Swans Mating. It's two five-line stanzas. And it's a poem, to be honest with you, that I'm so fond of. When I can't get to sleep, it's one of the poems I recite in my head. Even now, I wish that you had been there, sitting beside me on the riverbank, the cob and his pen sailing in rhythm until their small heads met and the final heraldic moment dissolved in ripples. This was a marriage and a baptism, a holding of breath nearly a drowning, wings spread wide for balance where he trod, her feathers full of water and her neck under the water like a bar of light.
Swans Mating. And you know, Michael, I live very near that canal. I pass those swans all the time. So I must say, I really love that poem. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm wondering, you know, which poets influenced you and continue to influence you? Are there those you return to, those that you reread?
Well, indeed. I mean, the central figure for me and for the writers of my generation and younger is still the great W.B. Yeats. But I would add to him Auden, Louis MacNeice, the poets of the Great World War, the First World War, Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon. And a poet I'm increasingly impressed by, the miraculous D.H. Lawrence. And as well as them, of course, there were three other writers who are central to my coming of age, as it were. Raymond Piper, a botanical artist of great aplomb, who made his living by painting vice chancellors and politicians and lord mayors. Michael Viney, who's a neighbour, he's now dead, alas, a neighbour up the road in Mayo at the end of the Boreen and in the house where we now stay. He wrote like an angel, and I learned something every time I met him, or every time, every week when I read his peerless column of nature writing.
Yeah.
And the central figure, really, the man who's given me so much, is David Cabot, Ireland's greatest ornithologist. And Corrigskeewaun is now his home. He lives there. But in the earlier days, we stayed there when he was traveling the world. But with extraordinary generosity, he loans me, as it were, the sole landscape of Corrigskeewaun, and adjoining it, Corrigan, and then just up the road where the Vineys live, at Talibon. So, I mean, what an extraordinary gift. And then, I mean, that's a huge blessing in my life to have known these three men. And of course, the treasure trove of the poets I've just named.
Well, indeed. I mean, I'm thinking as well of the way poets often talk to each other in their poetry. It's interesting to see that from the first in your debut collection, No Continuing City, you dedicate the poem A Personal Statement to Seamus Heaney, and then The Hebrides to Evan Boland.
Yes. No poem is a solo flight.
Mm-hmm.
Poem talks to poem, a poet talks to poet. And among the huge blessings in my life, first of all, my friendship with Derek Mahan, which flourished at Trinity, and we went, it was really quite edgy, but very exciting and often very funny friendship. And then when my wife got a job at Queen's University in Belfast, I returned home to be with her. And it was at a literary meeting gathering that we met, that I met Seamus Heaney for the first time, Seamus and his wife.
Perhaps we'll just finish on another poem, which brings another important factor in your life, and that is family life, your children, your grandchildren. Perhaps you'd leave us with the poem Amelia's Model.
This is a poem about my granddaughter. When she was about 10, she made a model of the universe out of wire and buttons. Amelia's Model. In her model of the solar system, my seven-year-old cosmologist ties to a barbecue skewer with fuse wire the planets, buttons, for Venus an ivory button, Mercury silver beside the sun, mother of pearl for Jupiter, red and green for Mars and Earth, for Saturn's rings a pipe cleaner, so that in the outer darkness, close to the kitchen, her brown eyes represent Uranus, Neptune. Amelia, you didn't include Pluto in your wire sculpture of the solar system. Tiny and very far away, an ice world of ice mountains and methane snow, a dance of five moons unlit by the sun, the god of the afterlife's kingdom. We shall go there when we die, dear child.
Amelia's Model, read by Michael Longley from Ashkey's New Selected Poems by Michael Longley, published by Jonathan Cape. Michael Longley, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and a very happy birthday to you on Saturday.
Thank you so much. I'll be enjoying myself.
Thanks very much, Michael. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena with Aideen Gormley. Born in Dublin to a family steeped in Irish traditional music, Aoife Ní Bhriain is an exceptionally talented and multifaceted violinist. With her father, Mick O'Brien, one of Ireland's leading Uilleann pipers, and her mother, Fidelma, a music teacher who comes from a large family of Irish dancers and musicians, Aoife grew up speaking the language of music. She is the reigning RTE Folk Awards Best Folk Instrumentalist, and the album W was nominated for Best Folk Album, a project she collaborated with the Welsh harpist Catherine Finch on. Now, a classical violinist in her own right, known for her impressionistic and virtuosic playing, infusing sound from Irish traditional and classical idioms with fluid ease. Aoife will be performing in concert with viola da gamba player Liam Byrne as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival, as well as in concert with harpist Catherine Finch. And I'm thrilled that Aoife Ní Bhriain joins me live in studio. Aoife Foilteoireacht.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's lovely to have you in person and also that you've brought the violin with you. I last saw you performing at the RT Radio 1 Folk Awards and so great to see you on stage. So I'm glad you'll be playing for us tonight. But my goodness, you've been busy since then. You flew in from where today?
Well, I flew in from Manchester because actually Catherine and I had a concert in the Rydale Festival yesterday, which is in Castle Howard in Yorkshire. So from West Wales to Yorkshire to Manchester to Dublin, it has been quite a 24 hours. I'm happy to be here.
It's all good. The violin, when I look at you play, Aoife, it's almost like it's an extension of your hand or something. I mean, it's so much a part of you. And I know many kids, and myself included, you'd start on the piano. But for you, it was straight away the violin at the age of two.
Yeah, it's funny. It's what attracts children, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, what kind of child I was to want a violin.
Did you ask or was it handed to you?
I did ask, actually. Yeah. So actually, believe it or not, I reached out for a tin whistle first. So I could already play a few tunes on the whistle, albeit probably not very well. But there was an amazing cul-de-sac that I grew up on called Verbena Grove in Bayside. And my mother actually taught pretty much every child on that cul-de-sac how to play music. And the girl across the road, Joanne Peat, played the violin and I wanted to be like Joanne, so it was kind of written in the stars that I would want to be like her. Now, she actually got to quit the violin a few years later, but by that stage I put my parents through enough torment and they said I had to stick at it. So,
and you stuck at it. And I mean, the fame as such came quite young. At the tender age of 9 years old, your first concert as a classical violinist with the National Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, that was so exciting. That was the first time I'd heard a symphony orchestra.
And there you were in the middle
of it. Yeah, and I refused to wear a dress and I got in lots of trouble because I wore jeans and platform Skechers.
Yeah, you were very cool.
And a big black oversized t-shirt. But that was amazing because it was the Music in the Classroom series, which is just a magic thing to do for children in school, that they go, like, they get to go to the concert hall and see children their own age perform with the National Symphony Orchestra. And for me, it was a complete dream. I remember the reason I wanted to wear the platform Skecher runners that my grandmother had very kindly bought me for Christmas was that I wasn't tall enough to see over the strings and I wanted to see what was happening at the back of the orchestra. And, you know, that was with Gerard Grant, who did so much for me musically growing up, just conducting the National Youth Orchestra. And, you know, he gave me the gig. You know, I had to audition.
What did you play?
For it. So I went in and played Dance Macabre, which was the chosen piece. And then he saw my surname and he said, Ní Bhriain O'Brien, do you play any Irish music at all? I said, yeah, I do. And he asked me if I could play something. And I asked him if he wanted the classical or the traditional version, because I wasn't quite sure where I was.
Okay.
You know, standing in front of classical people. I played the traditional version. And anyway, I got the gig, as they say. And oh, it was the most incredible experience for a 9-year old.
That is amazing, age 9. I'd love to hear you play, Aoife. What are you going to play for us first tonight?
So this is a recent kind of improvisation and it's the beautiful Stowair Port Nabucchi. And I've kind of teamed it up with some Pietro Locatelli. So I'll give it a go.
Lovely, in your own time, Gurmagath.
Thank you.
So beautifully played. Aoife and Ivrian playing for us live in the Arena studio tonight. Gurmila Margadish Shinga Hall in Erfad. I'm always interested with you, Aoife, because there's the traditional music background. You're classically trained. You studied in Leipzig. And there's this, you even mentioned earlier, this pull between the traditional and the classical. Do they sit very comfortably with you?
Absolutely not. It's actually quite tricky. And I think when you're growing up in both worlds, you don't think about it because it seems so natural to grow up, you know, speaking English and Irish and playing Irish music and playing classical music. And you don't really understand until you reach that kind of late teen identity crisis stage where you question everything.
Yeah.
And I think you start to question that too. And of course, the question was asked, should I give up one or the other? But you can't really, if it's part of who you are and where you come from and your family. You know, imagine if I turned around to mum and dad and said, actually, do you know what, the trad's just not for me anymore. It would be, yeah, I don't know, kind of heartbreaking.
Did I hear you say that you felt when you were studying in Europe a slight imposter syndrome that, you know, looked down upon, yeah, in terms of the traditional end of things?
Well, I just didn't let people know I did it, really. And, you know, in Ireland, people knew me as a traditional musician. So I didn't, you know, and of course people knew me in the classical world here as well. But when I moved to Leipzig, I could be a different person in a way. And some teachers thought the folk music was a wonderful addition. Like my teacher, Mariana Sierby, thought it was amazing. Other teachers, not so much. So you just had to pick and choose who you let know, if that makes sense.
We're so excited that you're playing several gigs at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. Tell us who you're playing with.
Oh, it's my favourite festival. It's just an amazing place to be. So the first concert is with the incredible viola da gamba player, Liam Byrne. And I'm so excited about this concert because we've really dug deep. We've got new music by Irish composers like Sebastian Adams, which is just, he's written an amazing piece and let us do our own thing with it very kindly. And then we've got some Irish music. If anyone has ever wondered what the Tommy Potts version of Toss the Feathers sounds like improvised on the viola da gamba, that's the gig for you. And then we've got the incredible composer St. Colum, who Liam introduced me to. And we reckon that St. Colum and Tommy Potts were somehow spiritually connected. Then I have a string of extravaganza the next day with Liam and Kate Ellis and Liz Knowles and Cleek Trey. And that's going to be just an explosion of creativity I can't even begin to describe. Cleek can make noises on the violin that I just don't know how he does it. I haven't even made them by accident. I don't know how he does it. He's an incredible creative force. And then, of course, I have the concert with Catherine, who is my duo partner in crime. I feel like I've reached my duo era. That seems to be where I've landed.
It's gone very, very well. We want to fit in a final piece of music. You're going to play us out, but I just want to let listeners know that you can catch Aoife and Ivrian in concert with Liam Byrne as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival, and Aoife and Catherine Finch perform on Thursday the 15th of August, 2:30 p.m. at Parade Tower, and Sunday the 11th of August is the other concert, 6:30 Parade Tower. You'll get full information from kilkennyarts.ie. If you want to set yourself up there again, Aoife, to play us out. I want to say goodbye and thanks for joining us on tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwo and Niall McMonagall was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. Aideen Gormley signing off. Back with you tomorrow at 7, and John Creedon is up in just a moment after the news at 8. But to play us out, Aoife and Ivrian.